All right, welcome back to Firewall. I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. My guest today is Justin Brannan. For those of you who are involved in New York politics, you know Justin. But let me tell the listeners why I wanted to have him on. A couple of reasons. One is he is one of the only people I know in politics who just says it like it is, says what he thinks, doesn't give a shit, and therefore inherently is, if nothing else, a good podcast guest. I think he and I also happen to agree on most issues, but even if we didn't, it'd make you a good guest. Second, he's had this sort of fascinating career leading into politics, which I think very much shapes his view and the way he handles politics, which makes him very different than everyone else. So, Justin, thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man.
So, all right, just so for the listeners understand, your district is 47 in Brooklyn, which is what neighborhoods?
It's Bay Ridge and Coney Island, a little bit of Diker Heights, a little bit of Bensonhurst, a little bit of Gray's Inn, but great. Mainly Bay Ridge and Coney.
So, for most, when we do have elected on, which isn't that often, but when we do, we kind of just jump right into the issues. But for you, you know, you didn't just sort of wake up in the sixth grade, put on a suit, and say, "I'm going to be a politician."
No, God no.
Rob, so you literally started out, you know, as a musician, as a straight edge musician. What was that? What'd you do? What was the band?
So I was in a band called Indecision. The other band was called Most Precious Blood. Hardcore punk bands. Put out a whole bunch of albums, bunch of 7-inches. Toured the world. Basically, you name a country, we went there, we played there.
Were you able to support yourselves?
So I was saying to the other day, success in music, whether you're Mariah Carey or whether you're my hardcore bands, is really becomes based on how long can I stay home before I have to go back on tour.
Okay.
So if you know, Mariah Carey can stay home for the rest of her life, right?
Right.
You can stay home for a month, 2 months, 3 months. So success is like, well, I can stay home for 6 months till I have to go back on tour
right. If
I want to make money. So the early days, it was not like that. But eventually we got to a point where, yeah, you could stay home for a couple of months, but inevitably you had to go back and play South Dakota if you wanted to pay the rent.
And could you make money on the albums, or were we already in the world of streaming where it was just
not totally... even? We were before streaming. We were like... before Napster even, we were making money basically on merchandise, selling t-shirts. You weren't making money on guarantees because that's paid to get to the next show. Royalties wasn't a thing.
And did you have like a van that you guys...
Yeah, a van and a trailer.
Around the country. Yeah. And did you usually sleep in the van or the trailer, or did you sleep
early
in hotels?
Early days, van, people's floors, and then you make it to the big leagues and you stay at a Motel 6.
So. Yeah, it's funny. I remember when I was in Chicago and I was in law school, a buddy of mine, Rob Galligan, had a band called Sunday Puncher, and they were, same thing, like reasonably successful. A couple of albums, a lot of radio play, tour... and they played at the Double Door in Chicago.
Oh, if you ever
played
there. Sure.
Yeah. And they slept on my floor.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like, man, this is tough. Like, you guys are like sort of successful.
Yeah.
And you're sleeping on the floor.
Yeah,
I'm like,
there's very little glory in
right.
That.
And it was not a, like, now if you came to my house, there's probably enough pillows for everybody. But back then, there's like one for me, and that was about it.
Yeah,
So then you go from that to Wall Street. So first of all, like, what in your head happened to make this sort of seemingly radical change? And then what'd you do?
So it dovetails, right? So before the band got to a level of quote-unquote success of being able to stay home and not have to work, I would temp. I would do temp jobs. Yeah. And a buddy of ours worked at a temp firm who placed people on Wall Street. So in between tours, you'd go back and work at the vault of Bank of America or wherever. So when the band was finally done, I'm like, well, what the hell am I going to do now?
Right.
I went, I took an interview for a job at Bear Stearns, mm-hmm. and I took the job. And next thing you know, I had a front row seat to the subprime mortgage collapse.
So what was your job at Bear?
I was, I was sort of working my way up, but I was sort of assisting they didn't call it hedge funds. It was alternative funds or something.
Yeah.
And I was sort of learning the ropes. And then I probably, honestly, if the world hadn't toppled over, I probably would have still been working on Wall Street.
Did you have, because I was at Lehman when things went bad. So I'm curious, I'll tell you my story. Did you have a sense that things were going wrong, or were you just sort of so junior that like they know what they're doing?
I had a sense things were going wrong because you started to see the bosses more than you ever saw them, you know, huddled in phone calls and whatnot. So you knew something was up.
Yeah. I remember with Lehman, I was pretty mid-level. So I'd never met Dick Fuld or anything like that. But I remember at one point saying to myself, if this were politics, because bad news kept trickling out.
Yeah.
And I was like, you would just rip the Band-Aid off, right? You wouldn't kind of just keep dying a death by a thousand cuts here. And that's what I would do if this were politics, but this is not politics and I don't know anything. And by the way, even if I had an opinion, no one would listen to it anyway. And then, of course, turns out had they ripped the Band-Aid off in the beginning, they might have found a way to survive, and instead they tried to hide it and it fell apart completely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I learned with Bear was that it was a real crisis of confidence, right? They had to do the whole, there's nothing to see here, everything's fine, Animal House thing, when in reality, the world was collapsing.
So the world collapses, and is that when you say, I want to go to public service to try to fix it? What happens?
So I had to reinvent myself again.
Yep.
And I think, you know, I grew up in Bay Ridge where I still live, and I own a home with my wife. And I think being away all those years in a band built this civic pride that I didn't know I had, because I was homesick. I missed where I lived, and it made the neighborhood that I used to take for granted feel special. And I fell in love with that idea of, like, I want to get involved and help my neighborhood. So I took a job working for my predecessor, Vinnie Gentile, had no idea anything. And I fell in love with it. I think the big thing for me was growing up, the reason why I wasn't the six-year-old kid with the bow tie saying, I want to be president one day, was because politics to me was old white guys in Washington making decisions about stuff that just had no effect on my day-to-day life.
Right.
Working in local politics, where the little old lady can come into your office with a problem that is the end of her world, and you can undo that knot in a day, in an hour, in a week, and send her on her way, that was politics that I fell in love
with. Totally. I mean, this is whenever people who haven't worked in government sort of say to me, and I bet you guys question too, like, hey, should I ever try working in government? I'm always like, yes, and do city government, right? Because, like, I've done city, state, federal. Federal, you know, if you're at the right age, you can do the thing on the hill, and it's an interesting kind of life experience to have. But city government, especially New York City government, right, you have the absolute, like, cause and effect immediately. So, you know, the little old lady fell in the pothole, and then you got the pothole filled, and then the next time she didn't fall. And then because it's New York City government, you have the scope of a country, an important country, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, to me, if you're going to work in government, work in city government, for city government, work in New York City, so you've got a pretty prime spot here.
Yeah, and I think you also see, for better or for worse, the policies that are passed, whether on the federal or state level, no matter what, you have to deal with them on the city level, right?
Right.
So whether good or bad, whatever policies are happening, you have to deal with the actual real life effects of these policies on the day to day. And that's what I fell in love with, because the immediacy of that. And I think it's part of a civic education. I think people have to understand that, yes, it's important to vote for president. All that stuff's important. But your local council member probably has more an effect on your day-to-day life in your neighborhood than who the president is.
And yet, and this is where there's just this massive cognitive dissonance, 99% of people complain about politics, and city council primary turnout in 2023, I believe, was 6.5%.
Yeah.
Right? And so the elections that affect you, your day-to-day life the most, are the ones that get the least attention, the least turnout.
Absolutely.
And as a result, you know, you are, I think, seen as one of the more reasonable, moderate people in the city council, but a lot of your colleagues are obviously very, very ideological. But in a way, like, when people who don't vote in primaries complain to me about what the city council does, I say, well, did you vote in the primary? No. Guess who did? The 4,000 people who voted for them are all fucking crazy left-wingers. And so, like, what they're doing is actually politically smart to appease the people who actually vote for them. Right.
So, like, pretty easy equation.
Yeah. And so let's pivot to New York City then overall. Just let's start super macro. How's New York City doing right now?
New York City, in terms of the economy, has proven to be durable and resilient and defying all expectations. I think for once, politicians at all levels of government are finally acknowledging the perception versus reality. I think something that drives me nuts is, we want to talk about crime or anything. Let's talk about crime. A victim of a crime, the last thing they want to hear is, well, the city has never been safer. Statistics say, and data says, no one gives a shit about data and statistics when you just got mugged or your car got stolen or whatever.
Right.
I think it's good that politicians on both sides of the aisle are finally leaning into that. But you can't lean into the hysteria around it either, right? You want to make people, you don't want to do the whole, there's nothing to see here, everything is great.
Right.
But also, we want tourists to come to New York City. And in order to do that, we can't act like New York City is on fire.
Well, right. It's tricky because, like you said, if you look at the stats, crime's not that bad, historically speaking. And then if you just get the sort of underlying feel between the illegal weed shops and the scaffolding and the homeless people and the mentally ill and the subway problems and everything else, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think it's important for elected officials to embrace that. The way you feel is always going to eclipse anything I can tell you.
So why does it seem like your colleagues don't get that?
It's hard. I mean, look, I would say, let's talk about, for instance, like the migrant crisis. I think that there's a lot of people who their experience with the migrant crisis is what they see on television. It's not affecting their day-to-day life in any way.
Right.
They bring their kid to school.
Maybe people showing candy on the subway is about
right. And you're right. They bring their kid to school or whatever it is, and they bring their kid to Little League. They don't see it. But when they put on Fox News or they read the New York Post or whatever, they're like, oh my God, it's a migrant crisis, the borders.
Yeah.
So, but we can't tell people they're wrong about that. We have to talk to them in a real way and not deny their reality. Someone once said, if someone tells you they're experiencing something, you can't tell them that that's not what they're experiencing. And I think that in a lot of ways, some politicians, that's their instinct is to lean into that and say, Brad, you're wrong. Because really, data says blah, blah, blah. And it's like
Bidenomics. Right. He's done a great job, but people don't feel that way.
And it's a problem. So you need to thread that needle where you're not leaning into the hysteria, but you're talking to people and trying to solve those problems and not telling people, you're crazy, you know, whatever.
So on the mic, let me just throw sort of a policy view out there. And I just tell me why it's wrong, because I don't quite get it, which is, immigrants are generally very good for economies, and New York City's economy very much runs on immigration, just like economies all over the country. Immigrants are also pretty fluid and smart, so if a community they go to doesn't have jobs, they will go to another one, which is why you see like Latino communities in Iowa or whatever it is, because that's where the opportunities might be. New York City is getting killed by the migrant crisis because we are assuming financial responsibility for the migrants, whereas my family, your family, everyone here had family that immigrated, came to this country and figured it out. And I don't think that most, maybe now it's a little different, but overall, most people immigrating aren't looking for free housing. They're just looking for an opportunity.
Absolutely.
Right? So if we said, you know what, it's all fine. We can't control the border in New York City. Like, we have enough problems to worry about. But they'll take care of themselves, right? And ultimately, if there's not enough jobs from here, they will logically go somewhere else. And we just sort of ignored it.
Right.
Why would that not work?
It's a good question. I mean, a couple things. Number one, I've said since day one, and I think this is one of the few areas that the council and the mayor agree, is that an international migrant crisis should have never been the sole responsibility of a municipality.
Yeah.
We don't have a Department of Resettlement, right? There's a reason for that. It's not our role,
yeah.
Right? And we're on our own here, right? I also think that, you know, like we just had St. Patrick's Day, right? So everyone's talking about their immigrant story. It's like, yeah, but my parents came here legally. It's like, well, maybe for that snapshot in time, the immigration system was working. But I'll tell you what, if it wasn't, your parents still would have come anyway.
Oh, for sure.
So yeah. I think we have to wrestle with that. Now, I think the mayor has done a good job in the sense that, like I said before, the average person, unless they're seeing it on TV, they're not dealing with it in any real way. Unless they go see it, like, you know, let's say they want to go drive by the Roosevelt Hotel and see, you know,
right.
They're not dealing with it in a real way, but it doesn't matter. It's still kicked up all this silt that we...
Polls is the number one issue in the country right now.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. And I saw a poll that was done recently in a congressional district where that's the number one issue. And I guarantee you none of these people
are actually... None of the voters are actually dealing with it.
No.
Right.
But we still have to deal with that, right? So... But it's a good question. I don't know. I don't know why we decided to say we're gonna do everything we can. I mean, it's what we should be doing, but it's never been like
this.
Well,
morally, sure. But at the same time, also morally, there's an argument that your kids, my kids, who we live here, are entitled to good city services and safe city services. And if those can't be provided to them because the money's being diverted to migrants, I don't know that there's... They're both sort of moral goods or needs, but as a result, it would seem like you would side with the one that's already your responsibility.
Right. You don't want to get into a place where you're talking about, well, the garbage isn't getting picked up in Middle Village because we have to take care of migrants. And that's a false...
But Adams has made that case.
He has, but it's not true, right? So back in November, Mayor Adams talked about he's going to make cuts to cops and the fire department and all the stuff, right? And I said at the time... It's not necessary. Once the Office of Management and Budget, the mayor's financial team, once they acknowledge the money that's currently already sitting there, none of these cuts are going to be necessary. And that's exactly what he's doing. All those cuts are gone.
So politically, here's what I don't get, right? And there's a lot about this mayor that I just don't seem to understand. But he announces these cuts, right? And thinks that he's going to sort of scare the White House, somebody into something. Doesn't achieve anything, right? And in part because... he wasn't thinking about it from the perspective of Biden, right? And I said to City Hall, I said to him, like, just have lunch with RFK Jr., right? This was back when Joe Manchin, take Joe Manchin a tour of the microphone. If you want, there are ways to scare Joe Biden and get and lever some money, but you cutting the libraries is not one of them, right? So he announces these cuts. Then Quinnipiac comes out, has him at 28%. It's the lowest approval rating of any mayor in New York City history. They panic and they start restoring the cuts. But to me, what's crazy about it is, you know, the budget dance, and even de Blasio figured this out, effectively is, and apologies in advance if I'm going to insult you for this, but like, you cut stuff that you know council members care about preemptively, and then you let them fight to restore it. You give in to them, and that's the final budget. But if you restore all the cuts before, then it's got to do it again. I don't get it.
It's one way to look at it. I do think that some of us who were around for the Bloomberg days, we miss the choreography of some of the budget dance.
Yeah.
That choreography is gone. So if City Hall says they're going to cut something, we have to suit up for war. We think they're actually, there's no wink-wink.
There's
wink.
No winking, right? It was there's all, no when wink, I was wink, there, we were just winking.
We're going to cut the firehouses. Yeah. I was out there for the rallies. They didn't cut the fucking firehouses.
Yeah, but we gave you something to win. Ultimately, you had a win.
Those days are no longer. So when they say we're going to cut something, we're playing chicken. He's going to drive us off the mountain if we don't fight to restore it. So it's a different posture that we have to take. I think candidly, they were upset that we didn't celebrate the restoration of the cuts, but it's like, but if you're acting like we don't exist as a city council, what do you expect us to do, right? Especially when we predicted that you were going to make these restorations.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance. The illegal weed shops, of which you've certainly got plenty of them in your district for sure. So the One House budgets came out in Albany. So for the listeners, this is like really technical stuff, but it actually matters a lot when it comes to New York politics, which is Governor Hochul releases her budget, and then each chamber in the legislature puts out their own budget as well, and then effectively those three documents become the baseline for negotiation, for which by March 31st they have to, according to law, agree on a final budget. And so what's in or out of those individual budgets is a really good sign of what's ultimately likely to come. And one of the things that's a trick that governors, you know, forever have used, and I, when I was deputy governor of Illinois, I used it too, is you throw non-budget stuff in the budget, because ultimately, if you have an agreement on a $220 billion spending bill, someone's not going to vote against it because there's some other policy issue they don't like. So the giving New York City and other municipalities the authority to just really shut down the weed shops, governor has called for it. The Senate, I believe, included it in their One House, and the Assembly did not. I just don't know a single person who thinks that it's a good idea to let stores illegally and openly sell drugs. And I commissioned a poll in the fall, and the data showed that overwhelmingly that people, and it's not that they were against licensed dispensaries, they were just against illegal dispensaries. Yeah. What's gonna happen with this issue? And let's just say somehow that Albany does the unthinkable and does not give New York City the authority it needs. What do you do?
I mean, the weed shops that we've been able to get closed, it's literally by calling in favors, which is not how a government should work, right? They completely botched the rollout. The fact that you've got, you know, 2,000 illegal stores versus, I don't know, 7 legal dispensaries is a problem. The average person sees a neon sign that says weed dispensary and thinks, well, I guess this is the New York.
You can't blame someone for not knowing.
So right now, you've got...
By the way, it's dangerous for them because they're also arguably ingesting products that are uninspected, unregulated, and harmful.
Yeah. Right. So now, when you sit around a table, whether it's with OCM or the sheriff's office or NYPD, you got everyone pointing at each other.
Yeah.
And a local elected official like me is like, guys, let's just figure out who's got the authority to do this. And the point is, they spent all that time working on the Marijuana Legalization Act without a real enforcement piece, which is insane, because when you had prohibition, you had to have an enforcement piece We all know the prohibition story. So now you're saying, and also too, is that you're opening up legal dispensaries now in areas that are completely saturated with illegal shops. So what it's the tax revenue is going to be a far cry from what we were promised.
Yeah.
And the black market is just going to continue to thrive, because no, it's not like when the dispensary comes to town, all the legal shops shut down.
Oh, they're here now. Well, that will be the
they're
law.
Not going anywhere.
We're just waiting for you.
Right? Yeah. So, but thus far, that has been the posture. It's been, well, once we open up enough, but guys, there's 2,000 illegal shops.
Not just that, but if the illegal shops aren't paying taxes, aren't paying all the licensing and everything else, they can charge less money, undercut the legal shops, which means they'll always do better. And the licensing system was set up to try to take people who had been historically disadvantaged in different ways and give them opportunity, of which you've destroyed that opportunity.
So now the problem is we can't criminalize what we've legalized. But most of the places that get shut down, no one's going to jail. They're just getting shut down.
Right.
But what we've found is that it's actually, the sheriff's office has been great. It's actually easier to shut down a place for untaxed cigarettes or for illegal vape juice than it is for having 20 pounds of weed in the store, which is just, that just sums up how insane this whole thing has become.
So again, in the stupid questions, if I were the mayor, I think if Mike Bloomberg were the mayor, he would just order the NYPD to padlock every single one of them. Every time it was reopened, put everyone at Rikers. And yeah, court counsel would say, oh, you can't do that. They're going to sue this authority, that jurisdiction. Great. Let them sue. Drag it out in court for as long as you can. And you sort of, leadership is taking action and sort of not letting sort of various sort of anxieties or political concerns get in the way of what's best for the people. Why can't this mayor do that?
I don't know why we're so desperate for Albany to give us the green light on padlocking these stores. Like, let's just go and do it.
Right.
It's let them. They're not if they're already considering giving us the green light, then they're not going to stop us from doing it if we do it. It seems like a hot potato kind of issue where
But it's a lack of leadership. I mean, Gail Brewer, I thought, had a good idea, which was declare a public health emergency, and then that would give you the jurisdiction to shut them down. Like, okay, maybe hold up court, maybe not, but like, why we're sort of just pointing the other way, it just really makes you question the competence and integrity
of our leaders. It's a diffusion of responsibility where everyone just assumes that the next person is going to do something and then no one does anything.
So the MTA, your constituents all think that the city runs the subways.
Unfortunately.
Right? So you you get blamed. Right. What's funny, when I was running Mike's campaign in 2009, the biggest fight he and I had was – I really wanted one of our big policy platforms to be to take over New York City Transit.
Oh, hell yeah.
Because my argument to him was, Mike, everyone blames you for it anyway, and you're good at running things, so you would actually probably make it better.
Municipal control.
And he didn't want to do it, and I think he had such bruising battles on school control that he just didn't kind of want to go through it again. Fine. But we've got the situation now where the subways, at the very least, kind of to your point about earlier, the perception and the reality, they don't feel great, right? In your home borough, there was an actual shooting on the train a week or two ago. Mm-hmm. So what do we do?
I think it's a couple things. I think with the congestion pricing thing happening now, people need to – it goes back to the crisis of confidence at Bear Stearns, right?
Yep.
Most people, they get on the subway, they're fine. But you know, the mayor's saying, well, 4 million people a day ride the subway, and let's talk about the 3.9 million, that whatever the hell it is, that nothing bad happens to them. That's not a very strong argument to make, right? But in order to get people to ride the subway, you have to do more than just tax the shit out of them and from driving into the city.
Right.
And I think right now, putting a guy in camouflage holding an M16 is not doing it. I had more people reach out to me when the National Guard was in the subway saying, did something happen that we need the National Guard here? And I'm like, well, no, not really.
What the council, because I actually supported Hochul in the sense that I think, look, would it be better off just having more transit cops? Absolutely.
Sure.
If we can't.
Right.
At least she's trying to do something. Do you see a world where the council, and I know that it's sort of city, state, there's a lot of different sort of authorities here, but puts money in the budget for more transit cops to try to reduce the problem?
I think some of us would be. I think also a lot of us also are enlightened enough to know that that's not enough, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just about, like, I think a lot about why we had leper colonies back in the day, right?
Yep.
Because
yep.
people just want shit to disappear.
Yep.
And that's just not how it works, right? I can't just make things or problems disappear. These are human beings. We have to treat them and deal with them. I can't just make them go away. So I think having more cops would do a lot for their perception problem. But it's not going to do a lot for folks that are suffering from mental health and, you know, this right. kind of stuff. So there's got to be a multi-pronged approach.
So the hammer, and the mayor has started asking for this authority, is involuntary confinement,
yeah.
right? Which is to say that if people are mentally ill enough or they're kind of drug-addled enough that they really just can't make any sort of rational decisions for themselves and they are a harm to other people, they can be held against their will in a treatment facility.
Right.
Where do you see that going?
In my experience with involuntary removals, I have a couple of folks in my district that have been there so long that they've been memorialized on Google Maps. They've been living on the street for that long.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to get them to make that decision. So when I hear City Hall saying, we need this to loosen up, it's like, but I've already tried to get you to do this on several occasions, and for whatever reason, you won't do it. Now, I think it becomes a catch-22, right? If someone's been living on the street for 4, 5, 6 years, when do you say, you know what, clearly this person needs help? Yes, I know you go out there and say, offer them help, and they say, we don't want help. Of course, but they've been living on the street for 6 years. It's not illegal to live on the street, but it's also a sign of some sort of mental illness that we need to get these people help. We can't just walk away. So in my experience, anytime when someone felt that something rose to the level of an involuntary removal, they've said no. They've given us a million reasons why they can't do it.
Yep.
So I don't know what they're looking for now. I don't know what they're looking for, what permission they're looking for, because anytime we've made that case, they've said no. And it's right. like, but
it gets back a little bit to a mayor. So in tech, right, and then this was sort of made famous with the Uber stuff that we did.
Right.
There's the question of, do you ask for permission or do you beg for forgiveness,
right.
right? So like, and this is true for lots of stuff I invest in, which is we can ask a city governor, state governor, whoever it is for, hey, can we operate in your jurisdiction? Usually the answer is going to be no, right? No, we don't want right. to deal with it. We don't want new competition for right. the incumbents. And then you kind of have to decide, am I going to do it anyway? Sometimes the answer is, I'm going to wait because I'm looking at 7 years in jail if I launch without a license. But sometimes it's like, okay, like scooters. Like, okay, so they're going to impound the scooters. So what, right? I'll go for it. I feel like we've got sort of a ask for permission city government at the moment where there are all these issues, whether it is involuntary confinement or illegal weed shops or, you know, migrant crisis services or wherever it is, where we kind of know what the right policy step would be for New York City. Yes, the jurisdiction's a little unclear, and we use that as an excuse not to solve problems as opposed to saying, let's be aggressive, let's take on a problem, and if a court eventually tells us that we did something wrong, we'll make amends.
Yeah, I think as long as we're always being humane and treating people with compassion and dignity, we can't go wrong. I think, I think a lot of people forget, you take Times Square, for instance, right? Times Square when I was a kid versus Times Square now, and the pain and struggle that it took to get to the M&M Disneyland Times Square.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that don't remember that. So I think it's part of a people that don't have the memory of those actual quote unquote bad old days versus what we're dealing with now. And I think people have been saying that things used to be better back in my day for 100 years, right? That's just human nature. But I think New Yorkers want people to just make decisions and get things done. They don't want to, when someone calls my office for a problem, they don't want to hear from me excuses about how it's a state law. Well, technically it's this. They're like, all right, can you help me with it or not?
Right.
And I think the average New Yorker, that's how they feel.
Yeah.
They want things to get taken care of. And I think as long as we're being humane about it and we're being smart about it, then we really can't go wrong, right? And instead of waiting for someone to give you the ball, just grab the fucking ball and go, right?
Yeah, totally agree. So everything we've been talking about, and it feels like all of the issues locally these days are responding to problems, and they're very real problems, but in terms of the bigger vision, if I gave you the magic wand and said, okay, you're mayor, king, whatever title you want, and big picture, where are we taking New York City over the next 20 years, 50 years? What big changes should we be investing in, making everything else? What would you do?
I think I love focusing on the stuff that people take for granted, right? So it's not exciting to cut a ribbon on a new sewer project, but it's pretty fucking important,
yeah.
right?
Yes.
The infrastructure in this city that's over 100 years old, and we're just jumping from fire to fire with this stuff. I think that kind of stuff is super important, but I also think that we're moving towards a place where, some sort of universal daycare has to, be taken into account, where the fight we're having now over 3K and pre-K is because it's the closest thing we've gotten the city to universal daycare. The economic benefits that that has, you know, that gets mom and dad to work so they can send their kid to daycare. These are things that we can't let other cities eat our lunch. And I think sometimes, and I saw this certainly during COVID, we let this New York City exceptionalism kind of blind us to the fact that if there's other cities or states or municipalities that are doing things more creatively, we shouldn't be afraid to steal those ideas and do them as our own and just make them our own. We can't think that just because we're New York City, we're doing everything the best way, because we're not, right? There's other cities doing things better. There's other countries doing things better when it comes to universal healthcare, right? So we have to see past that. And I think sometimes we let our pride get in the way of that. And I think it's wrong. We should be stealing ideas from, like when I thought of the, before COVID, when I thought of the idea of trying to convert office buildings into residential housing, I stole that idea from Washington, D.C. They tried it back in 2008. Like, they tried it. Let's try it here. Let's
stop. There's no monopoly on good ideas.
No. Let's stop writing op-eds about it and let's fucking do it. Let's actually try this stuff. Let's make this a laboratory for these great ideas.
Yeah, which is what makes city government so fun. So it's actually a perfect segue to my last question, which is, so you have this experience as a musician, this experience as an elected official, and you've toured all over the world.
Yeah.
What do other places do well that make those cities hospitable to musicians? And like, what could New York City do so that people, when they come tour here, it's better for them and they want to be here?
It's a great question. I think that we talk a lot about the stuff that makes New York City great, and then we starve the shit out of it, right? We talk about, you know, I represent Coney Island now. Everyone come to Coney Island. Yeah, have you been to Coney Island in February? It's not so fucking great. There's not a lot of tourists there, right? So you need to invest in these communities in a 12-month way, not just the 3 months a year that Coney Island, it's hot,
right?
Because I also have to take care of people in Coney in December when it's fucking freezing and no one on the beach, right? So, and for artists, like the idea of a starving artist is like, it shouldn't be, right? It shouldn't be that I have to starve and eat tomato soup to be an artist in New York City. And I think other countries, like we toured in Germany, we would play for a week in these clubs that were subsidized by the government just to keep creativity going. There's people in France where you want to start a business, they bankroll you, right? This shit can be done. Like it's not, we're not trying to, again, we're stealing ideas that are already working. I'm not talking about reinventing the wheel. I think politicians like to be cheerleaders for the city, and that's part of the job. But you also have to be funding this stuff. Whether it's, you know, I learned three chords at McKinley Junior High School. Those three chords afforded me 10 years touring the world. If I didn't have that little guitar class in public school, I would not have been in a band. It's this kind of stuff with arts and music that we have to really make people see that it's not extra. It's always, well, I gotta teach Johnny science and math. I fucking took algebra. I have yet to use algebra in my life, right? And I'm going on 46 years old. But those three fucking chords that I learned at McKinley Junior High School, they afforded me a life experience. So I think you have to be a cheerleader for the city, but it's not enough to just hold up the picture and say, look how great this is. You also have to fund this stuff. You also have to make New York City continue to be, back when, you know, Orchard Street was artists, you know, galleries and shit and lofts. Those days are over, right? So we have to continue to foster that, because it's not going to happen on its own. Yep. It's not, because it's unaffordable, right? If I'm an artist, I don't think I'm moving to New York to, you know what I mean? Especially after COVID, where now you sort of turn, you know, wish into wonder, and now people are like, I could do my job from anywhere.
Right.
That's a problem. Yeah. Right, we don't want that. We want you to do that here.
Which means the cool stuff has to be here to attract everything else.
Yeah, you got
to
roll out the red carpet, or else what's the point? If I'm not funding, we're talking about in the budget. We're not funding museums and the cultural institutions, and I'm not just talking about, you know, MoMA, and I'm talking about little fucking art school in Bed-Stuy. They need to be supported to engender that next generation. You know, otherwise, what are we doing? Right.
How do people follow you and learn more about what you're up to?
I'm on Twitter at Justin Brannon. I'm always talking shit on there.
He certainly is. All right, Justin, thanks for joining us.
Right on, man. Thanks for having me.
Firewall is recorded at my bookstore, P&T Knitwear, located at 180 Orchard Street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We'd love to hear from you with questions, feedbacks, or idea for a guest. Just email me at bradley@firewall.media or find me on LinkedIn. And to keep up with what's on my mind and my latest writing, please follow my new Substack at bradleytusk.substack.com. Thanks again for listening.